We meet here in an hour of grief and challenge. Dag Hammarskjöld is dead, but the United Nations lives. His tragedy is deep in our hearts, but the tasks for which he died are at the top of our agenda. A noble servant of peace is gone, but the quest for peace lies before us. The problem is not the death of one man. The problem is the life of this organization. It will either grow to meet the challenges of our age, or it will be gone with the wind, without influence, without force, without respect. Were we to let it die, to enfeeble its vigor, to cripple its powers, we would condemn our future. For in the development of this organization rests the only true alternative to war. And war appeals no longer as a rational alternative. Unconditional war can no longer lead to unconditional victory. It can no longer serve to settle disputes. It can no longer concern the great powers alone. For a nuclear disaster spread by winds and water and fear could well engulf the great and the small, the rich and the poor, the committed and the uncommitted alike. Mankind must put an end to war, or war will put an end to mankind. Today, every inhabitant of this planet must contemplate the day when this planet may no longer be habitable. Every man, woman, and child lives under a nuclear sword of Damocles, hanging by the slenderest of threads, capable of being cut at any moment by accident or miscalculation or by madness. The weapons of war must be abolished before they abolish us. For 15 years, this organization has sought the reduction and destruction of arms. Now that goal is no longer a dream. It is a practical matter of life or death. The risks inherent in disarmament pale in comparison to the risks inherent in an unlimited arms race. It is therefore our intention to challenge the Soviet Union not to an arms race, but to a peace race. The events and decisions of the next 10 months may well decide the fate of man for the next 10,000 years.
All these arguments were made against Social Security at the time of Franklin Roosevelt. They're made today. The mail pours in, and at least half of the mail which I receive in the White House and on this issue and others is wholly misinformed. Last week, I got 1,500 letters on a revenue measure, 1,494 opposed, and 6-4. And at least half of those letters were completely misinformed about the details of what they wrote. And why is that so? Because there are so many busy men in Washington who write. Some organizations have 600, 700, and 800 people spreading mail across the country, asking doctors and others to write in and tell your congressman you're opposed to it. The mail pours into the White House, into the Congress and Senator's office. Congressmen and senators feel people are opposed to it. Then they read a Gallup poll which says 75% of the people are in favor of it. And they say, what has happened to my mail? What is the government's business is the question. Harry Truman said that 14 million Americans had enough resources so that they could hire people in Washington to protect their interests, and the rest of them depended upon the President of the United States. This bill serves the public interest. It involves the government because it involves the public welfare. The Constitution of the United States did not make the President or the Congress powerless. It gave them definite responsibilities to advance the general welfare. And that is what we're attempting to do. And then I read that this bill will sap the individual self-reliance of Americans. I can't imagine anything worse or anything better to sap someone's self-reliance than to be sick, alone, broke, or to have saved for a lifetime and put it out in a week, 2 weeks, a month, 2 months. I visited yesterday and once today a hospital where doctors labored for a long time to visit my father. It isn't easy. It isn't easy. He can pay his bills, but otherwise I would be. And I'm not as well off as he is. Surely the opening vistas of space promise high costs and hardships, as well as high reward. So it is not surprising that some would have us stay where we are a little longer, to rest, to wait. But this city of Houston, this state of Texas, this country of the United States was not built by those who waited and rested and wished to look behind them. Man in his quest for knowledge and progress is determined and cannot be deterred. The exploration of space will go ahead, whether we join in it or not. And it is one of the great adventures of all time. And no nation which expects to be the leader of other nations can expect to stay behind in this race for space. We set sail on this new sea because there is new knowledge to be gained and new rights to be won. And they must be won and used for the progress of all people. For space science, like nuclear science and all technology, has no conscience of its own. Whether it will become a force for good or ill depends on man. And only if the United States occupies a position of preeminence can we help decide whether this new ocean will be a sea of peace or a new terrifying theater of war. But why, some say, the moon? Why choose this as our goal? And they may well ask, why climb the highest mountain? Why, 35 years ago, fly the Atlantic? Why does Rice play Texas? We choose to go to the moon. We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. For we have given this program a high national priority. Even though I realize that this is, in some measure, an act of faith and vision. For we do not now know what benefits await us. The great British explorer George Mallory, who was to die on Mount Everest, was asked why did he want to climb it. He said, because it is there. Well, space is there, and we're going to climb it. And the moon and the planets are there, and new hopes for knowledge and peace are there. And therefore, as we set sail, we ask God's blessing on the most hazardous and dangerous and greatest adventure on which man has ever embarked. Thank you.
The orders of the court in the case of Meredith versus Fair are beginning to be carried out. Mr. James Meredith is now in residence on the campus of the University of Mississippi. All students, members of the faculty, and public officials in both Mississippi and the nation will be able, it is hoped, to return to their normal activities with full confidence in the integrity of American law. This is as it should be, for our nation is founded on the principle that observance of the law is the eternal safeguard of liberty, and defiance of the law is the surest road to tyranny. Even among law-abiding men,
Few laws are universally loved, but they are uniformly respected and not resisted. Americans are free and sure to disagree with the law, but not to disobey it. For in a government of laws and not of men, no man, however prominent or powerful, and no mob, however unruly or boisterous, is entitled to defy a court of law. In this case, in which the United States government was not until recently involved, Mr. Meredith brought a private suit in federal court against those who were excluding him from the university. A series of federal courts, all the way to the Supreme Court, repeatedly ordered Mr. Meredith's admission to the university. When those orders were defied, and those who sought to implement them threatened with arrest and violence, the United States Court of Appeals made clear the fact that the enforcement of its order had become an obligation of the United States government. Even though this government had not originally been a party to the case, my responsibility as president was therefore inescapable. I accept it. My obligation under the Constitution and the statutes of the United States was and is to implement the orders of the court with whatever means are necessary and with as little force and civil disorder as the circumstances permit. It was for this reason that I federalized the Mississippi National Guard. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere. The characteristic of these new missile sites indicate two distinct types of installations. Several of them include medium-range ballistic missiles capable of carrying a nuclear warhead for a distance of more than 1,000 nautical miles. Each of these missiles, in short, is capable of striking Washington, D.C., the Panama Canal, Cape Canaveral, Mexico City, or any other city in the southeastern part of the United States, in Central America, or in the Caribbean area. Additional sites not yet completed appear to be designed for intermediate range ballistic missiles, capable of traveling more than twice as far, and thus capable of striking most of the major cities in the Western Hemisphere, ranging as far north as Hudson's Bay, Canada, and as far south as Lima, Peru. In addition, jet bombers capable of carrying nuclear weapons are now being uncrated and assembled in Cuba, while the necessary air bases are being prepared. This urgent transformation of Cuba into an important strategic base by the presence of these large, long-range, and clearly offensive weapons of sudden mass destruction constitutes an explicit threat to the peace and security of all the Americas. We no longer live in a world where only the actual firing of weapons represents a sufficient challenge to a nation's security to constitute maximum peril. Nuclear weapons are so destructive, and ballistic missiles are so swift, that any substantially increased possibility of their use or any sudden change in their deployment may well be regarded as a definite threat to peace. For many years, both the Soviet Union and the United States, recognizing this fact, have deployed strategic nuclear weapons with great care, never upsetting the precarious status quo, which ensured that these weapons would not be used in the absence of some vital challenge. Our own strategic missiles have never been transferred to the territory of any other nation under a cloak of secrecy and deception, and our history, unlike that of the Soviets since the end of World War II, demonstrates that we have no desire to dominate or conquer any other nation or impose our system upon its people. Nevertheless, American citizens have become adjusted to living daily on the bullseye of Soviet missiles located inside the USSR or in submarines. In that sense, missiles in Cuba add to an already clear and present danger. Although it should be noted, the nations of Latin America have never previously been subjected to a potential nuclear threat. But this secret, swift, extraordinary buildup of communist missiles in an area well known to have a special and historical relationship to the United States and the nations of the Western Hemisphere, in violation of Soviet assurances and in defiance of American and hemispheric policy, this sudden, clandestine decision to station strategic weapons for the first time outside of Soviet soil is a deliberately provocative and unjustified change in the status quo, which cannot be accepted by this country if our courage and our commitments are ever to be trusted again by either friend or foe. The 1930s taught us a clear lesson. Aggressive conduct, if allowed to go unchecked and unchallenged, ultimately leads to war. This nation is opposed to war. We are also true to our word. Our unswerving objective, therefore, must be to prevent the use of these missiles against this or any other country, and to secure their withdrawal or elimination from the Western Hemisphere. Our policy has been one of patience and restraint, as befits a peaceful and powerful nation which leads a worldwide alliance. We have been determined not to be diverted from our central concerns by mere irritants and fanatics. But now further action is required, and it is underway. And these actions may only be the beginning. We will not prematurely or unnecessarily risk the course of worldwide nuclear war, in which even the fruits of victory would be ashes in our mouth. But neither will we shrink from that risk at any time it must be faced. Acting, therefore, in the defense of our own security and of the entire Western Hemisphere, and under the authority entrusted to me by the Constitution, as endorsed by the resolution of the Congress, I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. First, to halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, will, if found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. This quarantine will be extended, if needed, to other types of cargo and carriers. We are not at this time, however, denying the necessities of life, as the Soviets attempted to do in their Berlin blockade of 1948. Second, I have directed the continued and increased close surveillance of Cuba and its military buildup. Should these offensive military preparations continue, thus increasing the threat to the hemisphere, further action will be justified. I have directed the armed forces to prepare for any eventualities. The Soviet missile bases in Cuba are being dismantled, their missiles and related equipment are being crated, and the fixed installations at these sites are being destroyed. It is in keeping with the exchange of letters with Chairman Khrushchev of October 27th and 28th. Progress is now being made towards the restoration of peace in the Caribbean, and it is our firm hope and purpose that this progress shall go forward. I want to assure the officials of my administration tonight that this demonstration of support for the arts is modest and painless compared to what has been required of past governments and past administrations. In 1664, Louis XIV, in his own efforts to encourage the arts, donned brilliant tights and played in a drama called Furious Roland before a happy court. Moreover, he drafted the highest offices of his administration for the play, so that according to an account, all clad in brilliant tights themselves, they passed before the Queen and the court.
This was suggested tonight, but for some reason or other, the committee turned it down. Today, as always, art knows no national boundaries. Genius can speak in any tongue, and the entire world will hear it and listen. Behind the storm of daily conflict and crisis, the dramatic confrontations, the tumult of political struggle, the poet, the artist, the musician, continues the quiet work of centuries, building bridges of experience between peoples, reminding man of the universality of his feelings and desires and despairs, and reminding him that the forces that unite are deeper than those that divide. Thus art, and the encouragement of art, is political in the most profound sense, not as a weapon in the struggle, but as an instrument of understanding of the futility of struggle between those who share man's fate. We have a special responsibility to the arts, for art is the great democrat, calling forth creative genius from every sector of society, disregarding race or religion or wealth or color. The mere accumulation of wealth and power is available to the dictator and the democrat alike. What freedom alone can bring is the liberation of the human mind and spirit, which finds its greatest flowering in the free society. Thus, in our fulfillment of these responsibilities towards the art, lie our unique achievement as a free society. Ladies and gentlemen, Mrs. Kennedy.
Tonight seems to be at long last the beginning of what for so long has really been just a hope or a dream. For that will be a reward to all who have worked so hard for tonight, and it will be an encouragement to all of us who must keep on working until the Center truly exists.
Is it true that during your first year, sir, you would get on the phone personally to the State Department and try to get a response to some inquiry that had been made?
Yes, I still do that when I can, because it's, I think there's a great tendency in government to have papers stay on desks too long. And it seems to me that's one really of a function. After all, the president can't administer a department, but at least he can be a stimulant.
Do you recall any response that you received from somebody who wasn't suspecting a phone call in the State Department? Any specific response somebody made to you?
No, they always respond. They always say yes. But it takes a little while to get. You know, after I met Mr. Khrushchev at Vienna, and they gave us an aide memoir, it took many weeks to get our answer out through the State Department, coordinate with the British, the French, and the Germans. It took much too long. It seems to me we've been able to speed it up, but this is a constant problem in various departments. There are so many interests that are involved in any decision. No matter what whether the decision is about Africa or Asia, it involves the Europe's desk, it involves the desk of the place, it involves the Defense Department, it might involve the CIA, it frequently involves the Treasury, it might involve the World Bank, it involves the United Nations delegation. So it seems to me that one of the functions of the president is try to have it move with more speed. Otherwise, you can wait while the world collapses.
You once said that you were reading more and enjoying it less. Are you still as avid a newspaper reader, magazine? I remember those of us who traveled with you on the campaign, a magazine wasn't safe around you.
Oh, it is. No. I think it's invaluable, even though it may cause you some, it's never pleasant to be reading things frequently that are not agreeable news, but I would say that it's an invaluable arm of the presidency, as a check, really, on what's going on in administration. And more things come to my attention that cause me either concern or give me information.
Mr. President, power like charity, as you know, it begins at home. And you seem to have one view of what we need to do at home, and Congress seems to have another view. How do you use the presidency, in Theodore Roosevelt's phrase, the bully pulpit, to move these men who really are kind of barons and sovereigns in their own right up there on the hill.
Well, the Constitution and the development of the Congress all give advantage to delay. It's very easy to defeat a bill in the Congress. It's much more difficult to pass one. To go through a committee, say the Ways and Means Committee of the House, a subcommittee and get a majority vote, the full committee, get a majority vote, go to the Rules Committee and get a rule, go to the floor of the House and get a majority. Start over again in the Senate, the subcommittee and full committee, and in the Senate there is unlimited debate, so you can never bring a matter to a vote if there's enough determination on the part of the opponents, even if they're a minority, to go through the Senate with the bill, and then unanimously get a conference between the House and Senate to adjust the bill, or if one member objects, to have it go back through the Rules Committee, back through the Congress, and have this done on a controversial piece of legislation where powerful groups are opposing it. That's an extremely difficult task. The only time a president's program is put in quickly and easily is when the program is insignificant.
Mr. President, back before you were elected, your father used to have a favorite story he told reporters. He asked you once, why do you want the job? And he cited the reasons why you shouldn't want it. Would you give him the same answer today after serving in this office for 2 years?
Yes, I think that there's a lot of satisfactions to the presidency because particularly, if, as I say, we're all concerned as citizens and as parents and all the rest with all the problems we've been talking about tonight. They're all the problems which if I wasn't president, I'd be concerned about as a father or as a citizen. So at least you have an opportunity to do something about them. And if you and if what you do is useful and successful, then of course that's great satisfaction. When, as a result of a decision of yours, a failure comes or you're unsuccessful, of course that's a great setback. But I must say, after being here for 2 years and having the experience of the presidency, and there's no experience you can get that can possibly prepare you adequately for the presidency, I must say that I have a good deal of hope for the United States, just because I think that this country, which is, as I say, criticized itself and has criticized around the world 180 million people for 17 years, really for more than that, for almost 20 years, have been the great means of defending first the world against the Nazi threat and since then against the communist threat. And if it weren't for us, the communists would be dominant in the world today, and because of us, we're in a strong position. Now, I think that's a pretty good record for a country with 6% of the world's population, which is very reluctant to take on these burdens. I think we ought to be rather pleased with ourselves this Christmas.